Hi, everyone, and welcome to another Ancient Warfare Answers, Murray's Ancient Warfare Answers, because, again, I'm by myself. And this time I'm going to be asking a very interesting question, well, one that got me thinking along very peculiar lines, and hopefully I can come up with an interesting answer. Of course, you could also ask us a question. You can send us an email. You can send us a message on Facebook. You can write a letter, send a postcard, send a telegram. And most of our questions come from our patrons. You can, of course, become a patron of the podcast. Just go to www.patreon.com/ancientwarfare podcast and you'll find us there. You can get a copy of the magazine. We've got three levels of patron: Optio, Legionary, Legionary, Optio, and Centurion. And today's question is a bit of a wiggly one. What is a useful analogy for talking about ancient warfare? Now, I was asked this one in a very peculiar context. I've recently joined the cathedral choir in Sydney, and so one of the men next to me in the choir, one of the basses, was asking what I did, and I told them, you know, I went, well, I do this, and I do this, and I do that, and I do a bit of that, and I do a bit of that. And they were like, gosh, sure, how do you explain ancient warfare? You know, do you use an analogy? And I find for myself that no, I tend not to use analogies, and I find that very often analogies don't work. My most embarrassing story of analogy was when I was teaching Roman history, and I had to teach the concept of mos maiorum, or sort of the habits of our ancestors, and I used the blue jelly bean to explain mos maiorum, meaning that when I was a child, there weren't blue jelly beans. Shocking to those of you who've grown up with blue jelly beans. We had different colors, but blue wasn't one of them. And when the blue jelly bean was introduced sometime in the late 80s, perhaps early 90s, it hadn't broken any laws. They hadn't committed any crime. But it just, to me, was something that shouldn't be done. A blue jelly bean shouldn't exist. And so what I explained to my students, this was in about 1995, 96, yeah, doing Roman history, and was talking about the Gracchi and, you know, the idea that the Gracchi as tribunes of the plebs could be assassinated. This was a breach of mos maiorum and da 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 da. And so, of course, when the exam answers rolled in, and I wasn't marking the exam question on the Gracchi, unfortunately, we got lots of things about blue jelly beans, which the lecturer said, well, what's all this about? And I was like, oh, no. So anyway, so I tend not to use analogies, even to the point as a military historian that I don't like using company, battalion, platoon for ancient formations. I prefer to use the ancient terminology when we know it. The problem with that, of course, is that very often our ancient sources use general words. Even the word phalanx means body of men. It doesn't mean anything specific. It comes to mean something specific, but you can still use it in its general sense. Similarly, the word lokos means a file of men, but it can also mean a lokos of the Spartan phalanx, which is a larger formation, but a lokos of an Athenian phalanx is a smaller formation. And unfortunately, we get used of the word lokos. What does it even mean? So that's really quite tricky. You also get a term like kuneus, which is wedge, which can be used in very specific circumstances to mean a literal wedge or an embolon in Greek. But then also in late Roman history, a cuneus can simply mean a group. So, for instance, when we've got the Huns, we have the cunei of the Huns. They are cavalry wedges, are they? Or are they just groups of Huns? Probably the latter. So that's, you know, one of the problems of going with specific terminology is often our sources are not being as specific as we would like them to be. But for me, that kind of idea, at least you can get to grips with it and get into the nitty gritty of working out what is a lokos in this context, what is a phalanx in this context. And, you know, that to me is much more understandable than talking about battalions and companies. And I think we're not as au fait with those sorts of terminologies as people were in the 19th and even the early 20th century, that those terms were used because historians were familiar with that terminology because of the amount of military warfare going on around them, and we aren't, thankfully. Having said that, when this was asked me, the sermon, and it's, and I don't want to say anything about where my mind drifts to in sermons, but the sermon that day, and it was possibly a bit of synchronicity going on, was talking about orthodoxy and orthopraxy. Now, orthopraxy is a very cool word. So what you've got in orthodoxy is orthodox doctrine. And obviously in ancient warfare, we love to talk about orthodoxy and heresy. For instance, in Greek warfare, we love talking about the orthodoxy of athismos and the heresy of a lack of athismos. And the people, to the point now where people who are heretical have decided they don't want to be called heretical. They want to come up with a new terminology. It's the new orthodoxy. Anyway, so that, of course, is the following of doctrine. Interestingly, orthopraxy is the sort of the correct following of ritual. Now, I started thinking that's fascinating for ancient warfare, because often what we have in our ancient sources is a description of formations and deployments of armies when we get them. Very often we don't, that are orthodox. So for instance, we get an assumption in a lot of Roman warfare from the time of Camillus onwards that the three lines are the three lines. And again, there's been some research recently to say, well, is it really, or was it more warbandish before that? Is it a Roman phalanx, or is it more Roman warbands just sort of joining together? And the three lines that we've given, the lovely picture, a bit like the quincunx later on, the checkerboard. Like, really, is it as defined as that? And is it therefore a kind of idea of orthodoxy being imposed on what we understand of Greek and Roman warfare, and that's imposed on how we view, and even, you know, how maps are drawn on of Greek and Roman warfare. And at the same time, that's very similar to the idea of orthopraxy, that you know, the three lines of Roman legions, for instance, and when it comes to the triarii, you know, things have come to a crisis. That's the sort of accepted idea of orthodox practice. I was reading a fabulous, I've got it here, I can even show you on camera. If you're not on camera, I will tell you what book it is. It's Deploying a Roman Army, which is a new edition and commentary on the Extaxis Cat Alanon by Arrian, by Duncan Campbell. And it, of course, is one of our very important texts from the 2nd century AD. And it talks about how Arrian in Cappadocia marched and then deployed an army of two legions and lots of auxiliaries. And he names them all and tells you where they all stand. They aren't standing where they should stand according to orthopraxy in Roman warfare. That's, you know, the legions are in front, the auxiliary are behind the legion so that they can fire archery over the legion. There's some infantry and some cavalry behind them on the wings. That's not orthodox in terms of either orthodoxy or orthopraxy. That is a very specific formation for a very specific threat to be met in Roman warfare. And when you start to look at some of the deployments in Roman imperial battles, where we know them, and very often we don't, we're not given the sorts of descriptions we are wanting in Roman imperial warfare. For instance, when you look at the descriptions in Tacitus of Agricola's Mongraupius, again, it seems to be the auxilia who take the lead, not the legionaries. That's not orthopraxy. That's sort of heretical. Heropraxy? I don't know, new word. Then you've got things like at the battle of the final battle against Boadicea. Again, that's not orthodox. And so the problem is that you've therefore got multiple examples of non-orthodox deployment. So it's not orthodox at all. And is that therefore telling us there actually isn't an orthodox kind of approach to Roman warfare? It was always practicable. It was always pragmatic. And whatever was, you know, there's a big word that I'm forgetting, begins with E. Expeditious? No, something like that. Anyway, it's always a matter of doing what suits the circumstance. And so when you go back and you look at Greek warfare, similarly, we've got this idea of how phalanxes deployed and how they fought. But when you start looking at specific examples of battles, actually, no. They're doing different things in every battle, whether it be the Battle of Marathon, where they ran, and we're told this is the first time that people ran against the Persians. When you look at the Battle of Plataea, that certainly isn't orthodox. That's very unorthodox. Similarly, the Battle of Thermopylae is not orthodox. The Battle of Delium is not orthodox. The Battle of Mantinea is not orthodox. Hang on a minute, where's the orthodox battles? Yes, exactly. There aren't really any. So that idea of orthodoxy and this very rigid way of talking about how Greek and Roman armies deployed and how they fought, and then when you actually go and look at the accounts, very often you'll find that our rigid understanding of orthodoxy and orthopraxy don't match what's actually happening in that battle. Expedient, that's the word. Sorry. So whatever's expedient in battle seems to be the way. And I think that that's really interesting as an analogy, that the idea of this idea of correct author, you know, correct doctrine and correct practice. And when you actually look at Greek and Roman warfare, what's expedient is correct practice and doctrine, not, you know, you must do this and you must do that. And in fact, some of the disasters of Greek and Roman warfare are caused by people going, no, 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 we must do this. This must be the way we do it. And they end up getting into massive amounts of trouble. So it's not really an analogy, but it is. And you have a vision into my mind as I sat there during a sermon and was thinking about Greek and Roman warfare. I did resist writing down notes because I thought that might have looked a little bit suspicious. Anyway, join us next time for another episode of Ancient Warfare Answers. Thank you.
At JCPenney, we make fashion count for everybody and everybody. Get pieces that fit and flatter at prices that feel good. Mix easy on cargos with breezy tops or polish your look with soft suiting. Step into JCPenney brands that get you, like St. John's Bay and Worthington, each in women's petite and plus sizes too. Guys, you're good to go in brands like Mutual Weave, J. Farrar, and Stafford. Style and comfort for all, even big and tall. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count. Yeah.